When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time. And one way or another, we get around to what it means to be human and how through craft, that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Mona Simpson, author of the novel Commitment.
I think writing a novel is a spiritual exercise. And when, you know, there's a certain point in the writing where the novel begins to give back to you, you know, and patterns that you hadn't planned emerge. And so you kind of follow them.
We'll be back with Mona Simpson after these essential words.
So June 2023 marks the 10-year anniversary of First Draft. The first episode aired on June 10th, 2013. And if the person I am today told my younger self that I'd be nearly 450 episodes deep into this show in 10 years, I would have laughed at my future self. But alas, here we are. And how did we get here? At what I would estimate is 9,000 hours of work I've put into this podcast. That's reading, researching, interviewing, editing, arranging the guests. I am the entire staff. And I guess the answer is, how did we get to 9,000 hours? Is a mixture of insanity and blind but ferocious dedication to sharing conversations about craft and literature. This isn't AI, folks. This is weekends where I sit and read and so many things in my life that get fully ignored for this endeavor. And I honestly consider it a gift to the world. It's a place where my passion and I hope some amount of finesse and skill marry together to offer this conversation you're about to hear directly to you in the intimate way that audio works. And if you get anything out of this episode or the hundreds that came before, or hopefully the hundreds that will come next, I am asking you in the most honest and authentic way I know how to please support this show. While I love making it and talking to authors and the entire endeavor fills me up, it does not pay the bills. And if we want to support art in this world and conversations about art and lift the curtain up and really talk about how art gets made, well, your support will help keep this show alive. It's here today because of listeners who became supporters. And that's the truth. So I'm asking you to bolster this rich dialogue, this juicy material, with financial support. It's not easy to do, but sticking with this for 10 years wasn't easy to do either. And it's not going to be easy in the future. But if nothing else, it's reliable and consistent. With every episode, I lean into the values of honesty, vulnerability, curiosity, and connection. I think about them as I create this show, and I hope you can feel them in the content. I simply cannot take this time to create First Draft without your support. Please join me on this journey by becoming a donating member to the First Draft community. You can support the show today at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. You can donate on a monthly or annual level. As a thank you to my patrons, you receive access to cuts from the interviews that didn't make it to the final show, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and writing tips from my guests. Again, you can become a supporter by going to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. That's patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Please stay tuned at the end of the interview. I'll offer recommendations on an episode in the archive that is similar to the one you're about to hear. And please rate the show on iTunes and tell everyone you know to subscribe. Thank you for your listening support. And thank you for being here with me today, right here in this moment. And on to the 400-something episode.
My interview today is with Mona Simpson, bestselling author of the novels Anywhere But Here, The Lost Father, A Regular Guy, Off Keck Road, My Hollywood, and Casebook. Off Keck Road was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award and won the Heartland Prize from the Chicago Tribune. She has received a Whiting Writers Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Writers Award, and an award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She is on the faculty at UCLA and also teaches at Bard College. In 2020, she was named publisher of the Paris Review. She lives in Santa Monica, California. Her new novel is called Commitment and tells the story of a single mother's collapse and the fate of her three children after she enters a California state hospital in the 1970s. The story's matriarch, Diane Aziz, falls into a deep depression after driving her oldest son, Walter, from LA to UC Berkeley. Diane used a fake address to get all three of her kids into a prestigious public school in Pacific Palisades, a town she can't afford to live in, and one where her kids don't have the same privileges as their wealthy classmates. Her middle child, Lena, works in an ice cream parlor while her friends prepare to attend Ivy League schools, and Donnie, the youngest, starts getting into trouble hanging out on the beach and using drugs. When Diane enters a mental hospital, her best friend Julie moves in and takes care of her kids. Commitment follows all four members of the Aziz family and Julie as they navigate health and love, duty and freedom, family life, and the world inside and outside of the mental health hospital. We began with me, for whatever reason, asking Mona Simpson this question.
I guess I kind of want to start and ask you if you were like a loquacious child.
I don't think I was a loquacious child. No, I was painfully shy. So I don't think I talked much at all.
Did you live in kind of your imagination and did you write in journals when you were a kid?
I think I started that sort of in, you know, in childhood, but not early childhood. I think I started out as a real reader of anything I could get. And then eventually I started writing, I think in, you know, junior high or high school.
Did you have like an early influence back then?
I had a classic sort of public school education. And so I just read anything I could get. You know, I read National Geographics from cover to cover. I read all those Stratemeyer series, the Bobbsey Twins, the Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, all of those. And I would read one in a day. So, and then eventually I got to libraries.
For the commitments and so many of your books, I think are so big and they hold so much. And this book, you know, covered a long time span of the Aziz family with three children and their mother and their friend and then their partners later. How do you go about when you have a story kind of this big and sweeping in time? How do you begin to write and organize something like this?
I usually write a long first draft and then I sort of outline it and get the, and I'm sort of always at any time in the last, you know, in the years of a book, I have elaborate timelines on the wall. You know, I just print them out and tape them up on the wall. So I'm always sort of keeping track of things like that and trying to, you know, cut out the parts that don't matter. I mean, I'm always struck by the transitions in Dickens, but like I came across a line in Bleak House the last time I read it. And so they live thusly for the next 7 years, you know, and right to the next part that matters. I like being novels that cover time. It is a challenge to keep the strands running and to keep the pulse points intense and make sure that there's not too much of the quotidian.
What do you think it is about the coverage of time that you connect with?
Well, that is our medium that we live in, you know, really time. I mean, it's our genre, so to speak. I'm just really interested in what that brings and how different choices play out in time. It's funny. I mean, the more plot, I remember when I was younger, I just mistrusted plot a great deal. It seemed very imposed on stories, but I don't know. I mean, we've all now that I've lived a few decades and gotten, and I've watched, you know, I've watched things play out. I've watched people, I don't know, I guess I've seen the ends of things a lot, which gives you a greater appreciation of the plot.
So with this story, you're mainly focusing on the Aziz children. So you have Walter, Lena, and Donnie, and their three siblings. Walter is the oldest, Lena is the middle, Donnie's the youngest, that their father disappeared. And he was Afghani and a mystery to them. And their mother, Diane, starts off kind of on shaky ground. You know, she's very sad that she's the single mother. She does what she can for her kids. They live in a not very good neighborhood in LA, but she lies about their address to get them in a good high school in Pacific Palisades and wants them to have a good education. And she's a nurse, but she starts to unravel when the oldest goes to college in Berkeley and ends up in an institution and being medicated for her mental health and depression. And the kids end up living with a friend of hers, Julie, who really is a saint and kind of takes over parental duties for Diane. And we're kind of watching each of these kids' journey, dealing with Diane's journey, and how I would say kind of that mental health is communal, that it doesn't affect just one person. And so I'm curious for you, you know, I asked you how you wrote this, but I'm also really curious about the inception of the idea and what you wanted to really explore with these characters.
You know, I grew up myself without siblings. I grew up as an only child with a single mom. And I would say my mom, who's now dead, suffered from some mental health challenges. I mean, she managed and she worked and she did all right. She raised me, but she definitely suffered herself. And I remember in 2012, there was Oliver Sacks published a piece called The Lost Virtues of the Asylum. And it was about he had worked for 25 years in the mental health hospital in Bronx State. And, you know, he started out by saying how we in our generation, you know, we're in the sort of post-institutional age. I mean, there aren't these big state mental health hospitals anymore. There aren't orphanages anymore. There aren't, you know, homes for unwed mothers anymore in the same way that all these institutions were around when I was growing up. And he starts out by saying, of course, the image we have in our minds of the old state mental health systems is of the snake pit, is a cuckoo's nest of, you know, but he remembers in his 25 years of working there, many patients who were actually helped by living in a smaller, safer world. And I guess this book started out, it's set, you know, right at the point where the mental health hospitals were beginning to empty out. So it was a little bit of a what if. I've always felt with my mother's life, as I said, I had a single mother who worked very hard and did her best and did pretty well, but suffered a lot. And I've always felt that what would have happened if there had been an alternative for her. I think it probably would have been worse for me, but it was sort of my questioning of whether it would have been gentler for her.
After you wrote this, did you come up with an answer?
I think, like so many things, yes and no. You know, I mean, there are so many, of course, everything comes down to people, you know, into sort of, and luck. I mean, if she had been in a particularly gentle, kind ward with a nice nurse and a good doctor, yes, that would have been good. If she had been in one of the more overcrowded places with someone indifferent or cruel, as of course that existed too, no, it would have been worse.
Did you feel writing this at all that because so much of your writing is influenced by your life and then you take it a step further, that do you look at things in your personal life differently when you write them out to conclusion? I don't mean just like the question about your mom in a mental institution, but if writing informs your life.
I mean, in this case, it really was all made up. I mean, my mom was never in a mental institution. I was never, you know, nobody in my family was ever in a hospital. for except for tonsils and so forth. But I don't think so. Although I wonder, you know, I mean, I don't think so. I think I'm usually living my life, just trying to live the best life I can. And I think the writing, I don't know. I mean, I say that's where this novel started, but it wasn't that I was actually picturing my own mother. It sort of took on a life of its own, and the people kind of became real in their own way, different from my life, certainly.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I think about how our creative process, which tends to be, I mean, it's generated from your own brain. Things in the world influence you, of course, but you spend years doing this. Like, a lot of times we must go out in the world to be influenced and to grow as a human. But I also wonder if our creative acts influence our spiritual awakening or understanding of ourselves or our connection to other people, just by the act of exploration.
I think so. And I think we're all sort of pattern making creatures, you know, so it is kind of, I mean, I think writing a novel is a spiritual exercise. And when, you know, there's a certain point in the writing where the novel begins to give back to you, you know, and patterns that you hadn't planned emerge. And so you kind of follow them as much as you impose upon them.
That's so magical. Amidst the toil.
Yes, both those things.
So, you know, the period of your book is 1970s, 1980s, which I think in some ways you said that around the time that you were growing up. And it does seem like in many ways a more innocent time for people. You're writing about Berkeley, you're writing about Los Angeles, you're writing about New York during that time. And I think what you're saying is, you know, because of the Oliver Sacks story, you were really interested in the time where things existed that didn't exist anymore. But I'm also curious about just writing about that time period and the musical references and the clothes and the way that families got along or were seen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does seem like a different time. And it's I think it's sometimes I like writing a little bit into the past. I mean, I admire people like Hilary Mantel who really take on, you know, took on centuries in the past. And I think that's a whole different thing. But it is sort of wonderful to write a little bit away from right now. So because you can see it more clearly. I think we can probably each pretty much understand even our grandparents' eras, you know, because that's all sort of in vocal memory of our families. And we know all that in a way.
In the beginning of the book, like I think it was on page 5 when we meet Walter in the beginning and he's going away to Berkeley. And at first he's going to have a classmate that he went to high school with, their family drive him. And then they showed up and it was kind of embarrassing for his mom. And it ended up that his family drove, but you reference too that the mom of that family, who seems really happy and perfect, is unhappy. So you're referencing kind of unhappy moms, and you know, you were talking about a little bit how your mom was dealing with that, but just curious about unhappy moms.
Well, in the very first scene, yes, the classmate's mom, Susan's mom, makes Walter's mom feel sort of inadequate because she's relinquishing her son to drive up with them. And so Walter's mom feels offended and decides, well, they'll drive up too. So they just take off on the spur of the moment and drive up, although they hadn't prepared to. And so it was a little mom competition between the more traditional mom and the single mom who obviously worked and was juggling more things. I think it was just a little bit of a flash forward at the end that Walter, when he gets to know the girl who he would have driven up with, he learns that in fact her mom, who seemed so perfect to his mom, was actually unhappy too. As many that was the moment of you know, the feminine mystique and. That was the moment when a lot of women were realizing they weren't happy with their lives. as wives and mothers.
And I think that the challenges of happiness were really on a spectrum with all of your characters. You know, you have the mom that goes to the asylum, but as I mentioned earlier, the kind of communalness of mental illness, like not just that everyone's affected, but you can be maybe have a totally quote healthy mind, but if you have someone close to you that you love that has mental illness, of course you're going to suffer. But then there's also the variety of the stableness of these kids and what they inherited or what they went through. And I am curious about your exploration of like happiness.
I think we're all exploring that all the time. You know, I do think in intimacy, first of all, I think mental illness is not a stable state any more than I suppose mental health is, in the sense that I think anyone who's mentally ill may have other even connected, even intimately related qualities that are kind of wonderful, you know? So I think that both things can exist. I think you could grow up with a mentally ill parent who also had a magical sense of reality, and that could be kind of wonderful and enclosing and sparkling at the same time. So, but I also do think that I think someone's illness in the family, probably not only mental illness, but any kind of an illness, it just travels through the family. It's not if you are or through the intimacy, it wouldn't have to be a family. But I think we kind of go, we do share the burdens and the exhilarations of the people we're closest to. And so for example, you know, the mother's mental illness affects the son at Berkeley, who feels less like partying, certainly when his mother is in the hospital, and feels an additional pressure, a sort of obscure pressure to just get his life in order and to do well and to make money. And at the same time too, one feels his love life is affected by it. There's a girl he's really attracted to. And at one point he sees her go off with another young man in a convertible, and he feels it's okay, because he feels he couldn't really handle it now. He couldn't step up to that next level of life experience or intensity right then. He didn't have enough to offer. At the same time, you know, there's a scene with the daughter who is really on a date at one point when she's in school and very much excited about this date, but has to explain, you know, when the question of asking about her parents comes up, has to explain that her mother is in a hospital and has been there for some time. And that's a very awkward thing, like when and how do you explain that on a date? And finally she gets to talking about her father, who's just not in the picture, and she can complain about him the way most people complain about their parents, and there's a little bit of relief in that. And so they each take on a part of it.
You know, Walter took a path where he wanted to make money. Lena took a path where she wanted to make art. And Donnie, he became an addict and then took a path where he was trying to make amends and make his life very simple. So I'm curious to hear more about how you kind of chose how the ramifications of their birth order and their relationship with their mom chose the trajectory or influenced the trajectory of what you wanted to explore in each character.
Well, even with the same parents, in a way, we don't all have the same parents, even if we have the same parents, because, you know, they're different at a different time. So Walter grew up very much sort of the first child, and his mother's hopes and dreams were very much pinned on him. So he has a kind of confidence, and also she was well most of his life. So most of her troubles weren't vividly clear until he was already away. So his trajectory is quite different. And for example, his sister very much worries is it in her too? Is whatever her mother has, will this happen to her as well? He doesn't really think that for a moment. I mean, that never occurred to him that he or his siblings would have these problems. Lena definitely sort of, like a lot of daughters, I think, wants to not be her mother, but is terrified that she is her mother in some deep way. And then the youngest child, Donnie, grew up very close to his mother, and his instinct is much more intuitive. He's less like the other two. He's a little less driven. He was a third child. He was left on his own to pursue what interested him. What started out interested in him was computer games. Then he got into a few other things, and yes, did experiment with drugs, and then finds himself eventually in rehab in the same hospital, in the youth unit of the same hospital where his mother is. And that provides a certain strange comfort for him. He feels like he was actually aiming for being with her again, even though he wouldn't have thought of it that way at all. And he's the one who ends up seeing her the most in the later years of their life.
And as you're telling the story about these three children, you're shifting points of view all the time. Like in the beginning, we're with Walter, and then it shifts, and we learn that we're going to kind of see this world through each of their lenses. And it's so subtle. It's not necessarily only just like at chapter breaks. It happens like in a flow, like almost the way that people think from one thing to the other. And I'm wondering how you, if this is what you intended in the beginning, and how you kind of manage that as the orchestra leader.
You know, my first couple of books were in first person, and I'm actually a shorter book I'm working on now is also in first person. So I guess I started writing with a very particular first person voice, and but as a reader, I really prefer the worlds of third person narrators. Were seen, you know, who's, I love the old 19th century narrator where they see everything. So I wanted that. I wanted that fluidity. I wanted that nimbleness. There's even some characters who aren't the central three, like the mother's friend. And of course, friendship is never simple either. I think in this friendship, Julie always had a sort of, it was a romantic friendship for her in some ways. She always admired her colleague and friend, Diane, and was aware that Diane had these kids, so she couldn't impose on her too much, but she really loved that friendship. And now in Diane's trouble, she has an opportunity both to help Diane, but also to have a life with children, which she never actually had herself. So I also wanted little bits of her point of view as well.
And how did you manage it? Like, did you feel like when you were writing, it just kind of came spontaneously, where you reached the end of a either thought or idea and you just moved into someone's head? Was it really finely crafted over time?
Some parts were just, you know, sometimes you just feel like you're taking dictation, and other times you work and work and work that transition 100 times. And it's funny, in the finished book, of the parts I like, I don't know, sometimes I like the parts I worked on the hardest. Sometimes I like the parts that I didn't touch, that the sentence, you know, so there doesn't seem to be any logic to it. It's not like if you work tremendously hard on a passage, it necessarily ends up better or worse.
Yeah, it's kind of like a good hair day. Sometimes you just don't know.
Exactly. There's a lot of luck involved. Although I do think I think that's right. I think the ideal is if you can get to the point where the parts you worked on very hard feel as natural as the parts that you didn't.
You mentioned Julie, and she was the friend. And at first, you know, they're work colleagues and you see them as friends. And we don't really know that much from Diane's point of view, but Julie kind of swept in as a savior figure. So I thought she was very complicated, because she wasn't necessarily doing it to be a savior. She cared about the kids and she wanted to help her friend, but she really dedicated the rest of her life of her adult life that we see to these kids, to moving in with them, to taking care of them, to visiting Diane at the asylum as much as she could. And that's complicated, even though maybe she made it seem like it was the only thing she wanted to do with her life.
I think she definitely had a sort of romantic friendship with Diane, maybe even was a little in love with Diane, but then also became very, very bonded, in particular with the youngest child. They really clicked in some way. I think the older children were very caught up with their own lives. By the time all this happened, Walter was already at college. Lena was looking towards college or looking towards leaving home. But Donnie was still a kid and was able to somehow really accepted her from the get-go. And I think probably got things from Julie that he didn't get from his mother. And she saw parts of her life expand. I think she was someone who'd come from Michigan. She had a family back in Michigan. She had a brother with some children. And she had her work and she had her friends, but she had a sort of carefully orchestrated single life the way some people do, and had it very very carefully planned. But this unexpected thing came into her life, and she saw it as something to rise to, and found she found herself really loving it. I think she found herself very fulfilled in some ways by her relationship with Donnie.
I felt mostly that Lena probably had it the hardest. Like, she didn't suffer in some of the ways that Donnie did later with his own addiction and issues for him. But Lena, she was so smart, but she was so stuck. Like, she was just at this very precarious age where she was in high school and they didn't have money, and she had to be the eldest one in charge of the siblings. And she made some grave errors about applying to college, and she was really trying to provide the best she could. But I felt like she was the most just stuck and agitated by it all. But I don't know what you would say to that.
Yeah, I think she acted out in many ways the most. I think maybe because she was the least separated from her mother. You know, she both rebelled against her mother, but felt very, very close to her. And so, and she does this reckless thing, which is she decides to just apply to a few places for college, and that's it. Doesn't do any safety schools, and then gets a job in a store, and finds herself able to do that, and is sort of working up the ranks of the store. So she's out there more than her older brother, for sure.
I felt when I finished the book that it was definitely about the mental illness, but I felt like it was really about identity. I think, you know, growing up and how you define yourself with maybe a mother who's in an asylum or a father who's missing, and how do you carve out who you are? How do you understand that? And I was curious about your reaction to that and what you think about identity.
I think that's true. And I think these three each sort of form their own identity. I think, like a lot of times when there is struggle in a family or poverty or anything particularly challenging, the siblings have a certain tenderness towards each other. And I think they remain close. So their identity is a little bit, the edges are a little bit affected by the other, all three of them. But I think that it's very much about what people do. I mean, William James writes about the firstborn in terms of religious experience, the firstborn, those who were sort of brought up in a religion, accept the religion, carry forth the religion, teach their children that same religion. And it's they're always in the religion. They're always believers. It always comes naturally. And then there's the twice born, and those who really have to kind of come to it on their own, who have some real break with whatever they were born with. And these are three kids who, in the middle of their childhood, had to sort of raise themselves. So it's really about an earned identity, not an assumed identity that they were born into and just grew up into.
Yeah. And I love how Walter, for instance, just realized, I mean, he was smart. He did well in school and he just was so close to the end of school. At first, he really wanted to be a doctor. He was very good at architecture and he just figured in the end, I just need to make money. And he did.
And he did.
I mean, there's not many people that can wake up someday and say, I wish I could make money. And they do.
Right. I have a partner who's like that. He, as a child, lived in inner city Indianapolis and across from a golf course and used to collect the golf balls and people coming to golf would come and buy balls from him before they went in. As like an 8-year-old kid. Walter has that knack. He's the kid who managed to, you know, rake everybody's leaves and he's able to figure that out. So he's also pursuing a bit more of what he wants to do.
Yeah, I felt like that's, you know, some people boomerang, you know, he grew up in poverty. Like some people sink deeper into it and some people sort of rebel against it. And he had the fortune of not really witnessing it in the same way as his siblings. So Maybe he had more freedom to have more belief or to be more resilient. I mean, I think he felt guilty that he wasn't there.
I think also what he happened to be good at was something that was marketable, you know, in a way. It's probably harder to become, or it's not harder, it's just different. He had a marketable skill, and he found people who could, he was good at finding people who could help him. He found his mentor who got him in touch with his first big job and he managed to do it. I interviewed a number of there happened to be some terrible big shopping center malls in Los Angeles that have been built in the last few years, but there's also a few smaller, more intimate places that kind of kept the old buildings and showed some restraint. In other words, they have a post office, they have a shoe repair store. They're more neighborhood. And I interviewed the guy who did those, and it was very interesting.
The other thing I kind of walked away with too are thinking about family boundaries also, because you can never, like you were saying, that the kids in a family are not raised by the same parents. There's a limit to how far your siblings can enter your life or experience what you're experiencing, and how, in some ways, how alone you are, or how once you do become an adult, you often don't care for your siblings in a similar way as when you're kids.
I think that's true. And even these siblings who, it's funny, I was just teaching a lovely Catherine Mansfield story, which is very much about social castes within a town. And the two little sisters who are at the bottom of the pecking order and who the other children are instructed by their parents not to talk to because their mother is a seamstress and there is no father in the picture. And they're very sweet with each other. And I think these kids have some of that. They have some of the closeness that's born out of having gone through hard things together. But it's true that as adults, you know, they're going to live their own lives, and they love their siblings, and they'll see them. They do see each other, but they're not going to live together again. They're not going to make their lives together. They're going to find the people who are part of their tribe and, you know, make their own adult families, whether those be literal families or families of affection.
Yeah. And I think one of the challenges that Donnie faced as being the youngest and the things that he was dealing with is that his family would not accept his amends. It's an important part of being in AA. His mother did, but the others didn't. And I thought this was really interesting because in a way, I don't think that they meant that, but it's kind of cruel. Like he was really trying to do that. And I think it was like never complete for him.
No. And it's almost a comic thing that he's a very sincere young man and he really wants to make amends. And of course his brother and sister, they don't want to hear his amends because they feel terrible that he's suffered. So they feel guilty. And also they're proud of him. They feel he's doing well. He's, he's beaten this. He's gotten his addiction under control. He's living a good life now. So they don't want to think about it. They want it to be done and they want it to be fine. And they certainly don't want to accept an apology because they feel guilty. The same thing with Julie. And there's even, you know, to take it even further, he at one point goes to a store where he and his friends stole a bunch of flowers. They had one of those grocery stores that has flowers outside, and they came one raucous night, and it was late at night, and nobody was attending the flowers. The attendant, the person who was supposed to take the money for the flowers, was probably on a cigarette break or something. So they took a bunch of flowers, and he's coming years later to this supermarket, talking to a manager and saying, "I want to give you money back for this theft that I performed years ago." And the manager, you know, with the pen behind his ear, is saying, "You know, I don't know anything about these flowers, and I can't take your money. We don't." And he says, "Well, can't you just take it as a tip, maybe?" He said, "You know, we're a grocery store. We don't accept tips." And anyway, it goes on like this. So yeah, it's true that, but he, you know, his realest life is with another person who's also suffering from a similar compulsion.
It's interesting how all three of them found love in the end as well, I think, because I felt like there were similarities between them. Like Walter, we see with both Walter and Lena, a person in their life that they either just loved from afar and were friends with, or someone that they dated, but it couldn't work out in the end, and how their hearts were kind of broken from that or just unfulfilled. And how all three of them kind of ended up with someone who was more their friend, someone who was more safe in a way, someone who, it's not that their relationships weren't good, but they had just all found love in a less dangerous way.
Well, especially Walter and Lena. I think Donnie actually did, the first person he was really crazy about and really fell for it. Amazingly, it worked out. In a way, to his surprise. I mean, he almost had resigned himself to thinking it wouldn't work out. And then it did.
Yeah, because you felt like he liked her, but she wasn't ready.
She wasn't ready. She was older. She was, I don't know, she had lots of objections to him in the abstract. You know, he was too young. He was a lot of things. But eventually she succumbed.
And the other two?
The other two, I think Walter especially really had a stark sort of crush on one woman who he felt was more similar to himself. She was struggling more in various ways and had a kind of romantic attachment and a romantic feeling about her, but ended up with really his best friend, who was the person he could always talk to more, and who actually tracked his details, and that felt right for him. I think for Lena, she was with somebody it just didn't work with, and eventually fell for one of her good friends. Although I think, again, in her case, it was sort of in between. I think there were some reasons that she thought it wouldn't work initially, but it did.
Writing about Diane in the asylum, she, again, it was the 70s. There was a doctor there, Dr. Moss, that the family really loved, that she felt safe with. There was a nice nurse that took care of her. I'm curious if you had to do a lot of research and if writing those parts felt different maybe than the other parts.
Not so much. I think I did do a lot of research. More than, you know, the way one does research, one gets interested in it, and one does more research than one even needs or uses. But I, the closest hospital to here, I live in LA in Santa Monica, and the closest hospital that's still, you know, still operating is called Metropolitan Hospital, which is in Norwalk, which is a little over an hour away, not so far. So I went down there a number of times and, you know, talked to all kinds of people and saw a lot of things, but ended up really getting to know three particular former employers, two nurses. They're all retired now because they sort of had their careers during this period. So I wanted to talk about this period. And they, it's very interesting. They're in their 80s, I think. One is a retired psych technician, and the other two are retired nurses. And they had so many stories of their life in the hospital. They actually go in now. They are actually put, they help put together a museum on the property of the past, of the hospital's history. But now they still are volunteering to put the archives in order. And of course, the archives are just endless boxes, boxes of files. So I think it's an almost thankless task, but they recall, you know, one doesn't want to put too rosy a glow on it either. They recall terrible things and terrible doctors, but also very kind doctors. And they believed in a lot of cases that they helped people. And they're very upset with, I think two things in particular upset them and upset most of the people I've talked to who had worked at these hospitals for a long time. One is the legislation that prohibits any kind of work. It used to be that in these institutions, people would work in the kitchen, or they would often have self-sustaining farms. This one in California, Metropolitan, had a whole farm. They had a dairy, they had orchards, they had vegetable gardens, they grew their own vegetables. And originally patients would work in those gardens. Then legislation passed which prohibited that kind of labor. And you understand, you certainly wouldn't want patients exploited. On the other hand, to have a sort of useful function in the community where you're living is a good thing, you know, and they regret that. And also they felt that now it's very hard for a hospital to hold anyone. So you had people who were really evidently very sick, who couldn't have been committed, and thereby, you know, left and really hurt themselves more.
Was there, and maybe that was it, but was there something that struck you the most about all of your research, from talking to shopping developers to nurses to visiting these places?
God, there was so much of that. I read a lot about, you know, architecture theory in this century. I think there were different parts, but no, there were a lot of things that really were very moving and striking. I think the shopping center thing was very interesting. That there were lots of little bits that were very, very interesting to me, that sort of air conditioning made malls possible. That's when they really took off. And of course, we're now sort of at the end of a mall era. I think these institutions, I mean, at their best, they almost functioned, it seemed, as kind of almost a factory town. Like some of the nurses went to work there right out of high school, and their parents had worked there too. And the hospital would pay to send them to get their education so they could be trained. And, you know, some people lived on the premises and had reduced rent in exchange for sort of more or less being on call some of the time. So it was all very fascinating.
Do you ever carry over researcher ideas from one book to the other?
I don't think so. It's funny. Somebody asked, some interviewer asked, you know, is writing books like therapy? And I was thinking that in a way it's more profound than therapy. It's certainly less expensive. But I think in some ways it is more profound, because I think when you finish a book, I think you're ready to let it go.
Yeah, it's like maybe a catharsis you didn't even know you needed.
And it takes a long time to get to that point. But yes, I think when I don't have a desire. I'm very glad to see my books on a shelf in my house, but I don't have a desire to open them and reread them. I'm afraid I'd start editing, revising.
So in the beginning, you mentioned, we were talking about time, and you said, I think what you were saying was that you thought about plot more maybe in the beginning of your writing life. I'm not sure. I don't want to misinterpret that.
I thought I didn't trust plot. I thought sort of, I was very suspicious of plot. I was suspicious of, I think the classic plot, you know, in the oldest novels, a lot of time plot has a moralistic consistency, so that someone does something bad and by the end they're punished for it. But weirdly enough, I mean, we see that in life too, you know, and it's not, I don't think most of us think of it as some, you know, patriarchal God in the clouds smiting someone. But I think just the human collective, I mean, if you are bad to people enough people, there will be some results of that. And conversely, the opposite. So I mean, I think I do trust more in the collective community.
You're not writing books without plot. You know, they have plot.
They definitely have plot now. And I think more so. I think I'm more interested in plot and the zigzags of fortune.
Yeah, it's probably different than maybe we were taught in eighth grade.
Yeah, very different than we were taught in eighth grade. And thank goodness we no longer have to write topic sentences.
You end the book with some poetry. And I'm curious both about some poetry and endings and how long you think about them, if they're more spontaneous, if it changes from book to book.
I think it changes a little from book to book, but I think actually for me, endings are almost always sort of spontaneous. I mean, I work and work on the book for years, and usually by the time I end it, it just, the ending writes itself, or the ending falls from the sky in some way.
And can you feel it in your body when you know you have it?
I think so. I think the ending I do feel. And then, I mean, in terms of the little copy editing things, when I'm finished with the book, I don't know about that. Sometimes my editor says, no, you're now making things worse. So I stop. But with the actual literal ending, yes, I feel like that it usually feels like the ending is where it should be.
I think, did you study poetry in college?
I did.
Yeah. And so what's the role that plays for you as a writer?
Yeah, I had amazing teachers too. I was at Berkeley and I was just very lucky. I had Tom Gunn and Seamus Heaney. Over in the Slavic department was Czeslaw Milosz teaching literature, but it was a golden moment.
So how does it play into your writing?
It plays into my writing only in that I'm a reader. I'm a big reader of poetry. And I think, you know, all writing that's interesting, you know, has to be done on the level of the sentence so that is, poets do that most intensely. So it's kind of always informing us.
Can you read a passage from an author that influenced you as a writer?
Sure. Well, I often teach Middlemarch, so I have millions of sections from that. But instead, I thought, since we're talking about a book that I'm not writing at the moment, that I'm finished, I thought I would read a little passage from Nabokov, talking about having written his books. He says, every serious writer, I dare say, is aware of this or that published book of his as of a constant comforting presence. Its pilot light is steadily burning somewhere in the basement, and a mere touch applied to one's private thermostat instantly results in a quiet little explosion of familiar warmth. This presence, this glow of the book in an ever-accessible remoteness, is a most companionable feeling, and the better the book has conformed to its prefigured contour and color, the ampler and smoother it glows. But even so, there are certain points, byroads, favorite hollows that one evokes more eagerly and enjoys more tenderly than the rest of one's book.
And what is that from? And do you want to tell us more about choosing that?
That's from a little section he wrote. That's from a little commentary he wrote years after having written Lolita.
And is there anything else you want to say about it?
Well, he goes on then to sort of name his favorite points of the book, which are very small points in which many readers might just gloss over, but for him, they're kind of the underpinning.
Can you read something that you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard to write or change from the first draft or something you liked?
Sure. This is a section of Lena on a date, wondering with someone she really likes. In a basement hamburger place, Sasha asked about her parents. She looked down at the paper placemat and told him her mother was in a state institution. As facts of her mother's illness spilled out, it sounded as if she were exaggerating. Lithium, Elavil, Thorazine. There was no way to translate the truth about her life that sounded sincere. When she lifted her eyes, she saw his face ratcheted into high alarm. He tried to talk, but his jaw moved without words. Has she been there long? He finally managed. 6 years. Everything about him was exactly right, even things she normally wouldn't like. His relish for Cokes, for example, or red meat. Is she getting better, do you think? I don't know, Nina said. She'd once sent her friend Jess, a scientist, a list of the drugs her mother was on and asked if she could tell her what they did. Jess tried to explain and Lena got lost. She asked Jess if a normal brain made by itself the compounds that were in the drugs. The chemical imbalance model, it's just a metaphor, Jess had said. We develop these compounds to treat an illness, usually cancer, that's where the money is. Say it doesn't work, but they notice the trial subjects report feeling a little happier, so then they do another trial. So we have these drugs that sometimes work. That's all we really know. Lena's father was easier to talk about. For most of her life, they hadn't had a working telephone number for him. But now, at 60, he had the first job Lena had heard of since he'd married Lucille decades ago. He was the general concessions manager in a casino on the Idaho-Nevada border. She could talk about him the way most people their age talked about their parents, with patient, understanding scorn.
Do you want to share about why you chose that one?
I chose that one because it seemed on the, you know, dating is kind of a light thing in life. It's not the most... You know, but even in something like dating, her mother's situation comes up.
Where do you write?
I write. Oh, it's funny. When I was younger, my goal in life, my dream was to have an office, and I used to write in an office, and I actually have an office in Santa Monica, which I sublet now, and I also have an office at UCLA. Neither of which I work in these days. I like to work at home close to the, you know, the coffee maker and close to where I can make my own coffee and grab food and where the dog is welcome. And it's funny, I work in different places in the house. I'm right now in the dining room table. But often I'm my children are grown. I'm during the day I'm alone in the house. I sometimes work as one would in college, you know, on my bed.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I do a lot of things other than writing. I'm not sure I do them specifically to get away, but I hike, I swim, I do a lot of things like that. I used to be a runner, so I used to run 5-6 miles every day. Now I'm doing other things. I'm biking and hiking. What else do I do? I teach, you know, I do a lot of things. I've recently started going back to movies, which is so exciting. Go to museums, mostly see friends.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
Actually, this novel was really wonderful in that I have two good friends who are novelists whose work I respect immensely. And, Michelle Hunnevin and Yi-Yun Lee. And with both of them, we formed our own ways. Michelle and I actually, at one point we had drafts, so we actually literally read out loud our entire novels to the other one over a weekend. It was fantastic. And Yi-Yun and I have a pattern where we share work at the end of the week. So usually Fridays, our deadline is Friday, although we sometimes give ourselves leeway till Sunday. And we're doing that now again with our new books, but we send whatever we manage to do that week. And once in a while, we'll have a week where for example, I'm on a search committee at UCLA. So I've been a little taken up with that. And once in a while, we'll have a week where we'll say, well, I really wasn't able to, but even that accounting is a good thing. And it's been just great. So I feel very lucky.
How do you deal with rejection?
Oh, that's a hard one. I was just talking to one of my students asked that a few days ago. I think as much as possible, it's good to do not take it personally and to learn from it if there's anything that can be learned from, and mostly just to move on. More than one friend who's been an editor has told me the following, I guess it's a trend or a fact even, but they will say that if they write a rejection letter to a young man, often they'll get an encouraging rejection letter. They'll often get another manuscript the next day or 2 days later. And sometimes they write the same level of a rejection letter with the same level of encouragement to a young woman, and they never hear from her again. So I think the main thing is don't take it personally. Keep going. Remember that this is not a field that has empirical standards that can be tested on everyone. I mean, anyone who has any doubts about the justice of the hierarchy just should look at the list of Pulitzer Prize winners from the 20s and 30s. They're largely books you haven't heard of, you know, while Faulkner was publishing. You know, many people were eligible for the Nobel Prize who did not get it, and many people we don't read anymore do. So, I mean, from the very top level of accolade down, there is really no absolute standard. And really, we're all reading for pleasure and for edification and for what we connect with personally. So it's kind of your job to keep trying until you find the reader that's right for you.
What is your favorite word?
Oh, I kept thinking of that, and I couldn't think of it. Henry James said that a summer afternoon were the most beautiful words in the English language. And I thought of the phrase, we have time. I like that.
Thank you so much for your time and sharing this hour.
This was so nice.
If you liked today's show with Mona Simpson, author of the novel Commitment, check out my interview with Ursula Hagee, author of the novel The Patron Saint of Pregnant Girls. We talked about how she has to become her characters to write about them, transitioning from German to English in her dreams, and quitting writing, or trying to quit, for several years after many rejections. You can find that interview and the entire First Draft archive of more than 400 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And please send some 10-year anniversary love. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with T.C. Boyle, Sebastian Barry, and Adrian Brodeur. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft, a dialogue on writing, a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.